Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Some nights, I'm just really grateful for the fact that we're on the internet. And this is one of those nights because the summer slump is hit. So it's good to know that there's people out there on the internet listening. Oh, first I have to tell you this, because this is very exciting. Jeff Young is a magician. You haven't seen it yet, but I have seen it. The archive section of the GCA website. We've been working on it now for a couple of weeks. Only Jeff and I have seen it, but it's really spanky. It's really good. Megan has seen it as well, right? And did it achieve spankiness? Was I correct? It's super spanky, according to her. So what it is we have bought 100 gigabyte of space on a huge server. And so we have begun archiving every recording, every video, everything that GCA has ever done. Every message that we've ever preached is going to be available on our website. And when you go to our regular website, you'll be able to just click on a link that says Archives. And it will look for all the world like you're still on our website, even as it takes you over to a different server and to a different way. And that's the part of it that's really cool. Jeff has worked his magic on it, where you don't even have to go type in a different address or go to a different website or go chase stuff. All you do is just click through our website like you normally would, and suddenly you find yourself in a place where there's 140 messages on Luke. There's 120-something eschatology messages. The Acts messages are up there. The entire Romans series thus far is up there. Everything we've ever done is up there. And I have been frustrated by Google Video and YouTube Video and the couple places like that where we've put our videos, you know, up until now, because they take your original video and they change it into Flash Video. So it never looks as good, it's not as sharp, it doesn't play as good. Flash Video's been getting better, but I prefer being able to watch like a Windows Media File video or a Real Player file. So we have so much space that I'm going to be making those videos of like Barney Johnson's message or the Lexington messages or just everything we have on video so far and putting that all up in the archive as well. And we're even talking about having a space for just Sovereign Grace music. There's just so much room to do so many things, and Jeff has already made it look so good and it works so well that I think you're all going to be really enthused the first time you click the archive button. And no one's ever going to be able to say to me ever again, I can't find anything to listen to. Jim, I can't find anything to listen to. Well, click this button and there's over 400 messages sitting over there. How's that? Does that work for you? There's no way you've heard all of them. Go find something to listen to. So I'm really enthused by that. And Jeff has done excellent work. Now, this is the Smyrna AM newspaper, which is actually an insert, a part of the Gannett Tennessean Publishing Company. And this paper comes out every Wednesday in every mailbox in Smyrna. And I was told by Robin a couple weeks ago that the editor of this newspaper was asking for specifically religious articles. So I submitted, naturally, an article. And last week they had the first of their religious articles published, and this week the second, and it was mine. So that's exciting. I'll put a link to it up on my blog, so folks listening out on the internet who want to go read it can. But it's called Putting the Fun in Fundamentalism, although they shortened my original title to Put the Fun in Fundamentalism, which is not exactly what I wrote, but Put the Fun in Fundamentalism. Want to hear it? I'll read it to you. Because I think there's nothing more fun than listening to Jim read. That's my theory. The article goes like this. So what kind of preacher are you? A woman recently asked. You're not one of those fundamentalists, are you? I knew what she was driving at. One small segment of evangelical Christianity has usurped the term fundamentalism and redefined it so that only they fit the category. Now, when we think of fundamentalists, We imagine fire-breathing pulpiteers who spend their time listing all the things they reject and condemning everyone with whom they disagree. And that's a shame, because fundamentalism is not a bad word. Yes, I replied, I am a fundamentalist. She took a couple steps back. I assured her I wouldn't bite. You see, I am an adamant defender of the fundamentals of the Christian faith. The virgin birth, the sinless life, the death, burial, and resurrection, those are all fundamental to Christianity. Without those basics, you have no faith. I asked her, would you go to a doctor who didn't understand the rudiments of medicine? Or would you trust an auto mechanic who didn't know how engines work? She said, of course not. She was catching my drift. The same way that we would never trust our bodies or even our cars to the care of someone who lacked the fundamentals, we should never entrust our spiritual well-being to someone who ignores the basics. In theological circles, those fundamentals are called doctrines. A doctrine is simply something taught as a rule or principle of the faith, and the principles of Christianity are built on those fundamental doctrines. So don't be afraid to call yourself a fundamentalist. Study the doctrines and construct your faith from those basic building blocks. That's the method Jesus prescribed. He said, therefore, whosoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house upon a rock. Matthew 7:24. So, yep, I'm a fundamentalist. I love the doctrines of the Christian faith, and I am not ashamed to say so. Recently, one of our congregants told me, as we keep teaching the Bible, we're going to be known as the church that put the mental back in fundamentalism. I smiled, you're right, but wouldn't it be great to be known as the church that put the fun back, too? So there's my article. Don't break into spontaneous applause. That's okay. But that's the, and then they put, Jim McLarty is the pastor of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship. For more information, visit the church's website. They included our web address. So that's great. That went into every mailbox in Smyrna today. And hopefully a few folks will read that and go click on the website and find out that we exist. Because I will do anything to let the community know that we're over here and what it is we're doing. And the most common thing that I keep hearing, I got an email again today from a fella who is in Bible college. And his frustration is that what he's learning, what he's being taught, the church he's going to, that they're all just wandering so far afield from basic historic Christianity and have begun embracing all of this seeker-sensitive stuff. And they're really getting into the whole 40 days of purpose stuff. And they're just, you know, the church is dumbing down in order to attract more dumbed down people. And they're not willing to engage people and say, why don't we study? Why don't we learn? Why don't we actually advance the cause of Christianity the way it's written in the Bible? Because they're so busy trying to make it user-friendly. Yeah.
Well, they're dumbing it down. One poll, and the other poll is, do you have your secret decoder ring? Because there's always some extra little piece of, yeah, of teaching that you need to advance one step further or get, yep, a little closer.
Some private word. Yeah. But how much Bible is there in either of those groups? And that's the frustration. And I'm hearing it so frequently that I hope there are people in Smyrna who will pick up that article, read it, and go, well, all right, I'll take a chance and type in salvation by grace and find out that there's all this material. And soon, 400 more messages to listen to, so they can never say they don't have plenty of stuff to listen to. We are finally back in Genesis, Genesis 33. It was my original intention to get us all the way through chapter 35 tonight. Well, at least halfway through it. We may or may not make that. When we last saw Jacob, he had wrestled through the night with a man that I have argued is a Christophany. And one of the additional pieces of evidence that I would like to offer for the idea that this is a Christophany, other than the fact that Jacob himself says in verse 30 of chapter 32, Jacob called the place Penuel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. He certainly seems to believe that he came in contact with God. And yet as we get to, when we get to the middle of chapter 35, 35, verse 9, it says, then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him, and God said to him, your name is Jacob, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name, which is identical to what we read in the wrestling. Chapter 32, verse 27, what is your name? He said, Jacob, and he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men, and you have prevailed. So in chapter 35, it is clearly identified as God who says these things to him. And we read it in chapter 32, same language, same change of name. The language continues to build up and mount up that he actually wrestled with God. Well, if he wrestled with God in some kind of man-type form, that is the very definition of a Christophany, the image of God here wrestling on earth. Now, if that is true, then Jacob is on his way to the promised land. He is on his way to inherit the very thing that Abraham and Isaac have been promised, this land of Canaan. But as I've said repeatedly, you see God intersecting the lives of these men, and you see Christophanies intersecting the lives of these men as they are inheriting the Abrahamic promise. And the point I'm trying to make in repeating that over and over is that I see Christ as being actively involved in the formation and in the keeping and in the passing on of the Abrahamic covenant. People far too frequently think of Israel in the Old Testament and God in the Old Testament as being separate from the Christ and the Christianity of the New Testament. And if I have hopefully proven anything through our study of the book of Acts, it's that Paul always argued for continuity between the Old and New Testament, that it was the same God working in Israel nationally and in the church of every nation and tongue and kindred and people and tribe, that it was always the same God working the same redemptive plan from beginning to end. And so if that's the case, then it's not surprising to find Christophanies, to find Christ actually involved in the keeping of the unconditional covenant that was given to Abraham. And if that's the case, then that really helps our Israelology. That really helps our thinking about God's promises and covenants to Israel. Again, because folks will argue that New Testament promises are solid because they are rooted and grounded in Christ. And all our promises of salvation and redemption and our heavenly inheritance, those are solid and secure because they're in Christ. But the promises that were made in the Old Testament were made by God in some sort of exclusive way to Israel and therefore can be either ignored or spiritualized or just not come to any physical fruition. And that's okay because those weren't apparently Christ involved, or apparently Christ was not involved in those. One of those two sentences is accurate. I argue that no, whenever God has worked, the triunity of God has worked. God has never said, you know, now the Father's going to work independent of the Son and the Spirit. You certainly would have to argue that if the Logos is the speaking agency of the Godhead, as John 1 says, then it's clear that Christ was involved from the beginning, from the creation. At the very first day of the very first thing, of the very first activity of God, Christ was there. He was active. He made everything. He formed everything by himself, for himself. If that's the case, then he would be active in every redemptive purpose of God, and that would have to include everything he did with Israel. That make sense? Have I lost anybody there? Okay. So that would then take us to chapter 33. Jacob then lifted up his eyes and he looked. Now, the last time we saw Jacob, he was hiding from his brother Esau. You remember this? He had sent all his cattle. He had sent all his men servants and women servants. He sent his wives. He sent his kids. He sent everybody ahead of him, and he stayed on the other side of the brook. And he sent wave after wave of gifts to his brother Esau in the hope that he could abate the anger and the hatred of Esau so that when he finally met his brother wouldn't kill him, which was precisely the reason he had run away 20 years prior, was to avoid his brother's intention to kill him. So Jacob lifted his eyes and he looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. And he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. The idea there is that when his brother would see him far off, he would get down on his face, a sign of obedience, a sign of you're the ruler in this instance. And then he would get up and travel a little bit, and then he'd get on his face again. Then he'd get up and travel a little bit, and he'd get on his face again. So those 7 times were progressively getting closer and closer to his brother, bowing down and bowing down so that his brother knew that he was not coming in any sort of aggressive way. He was coming in a humble way toward him. So he bowed down on the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. That had to have been a huge surprise to Jacob, that his brother came running. Now, when his brother comes running, that had to have been a tense moment. And then his brother falls on his neck and hugs him and kisses him, and they both break down crying. Something changed, obviously, in Esau. It wasn't the gifts, because he already argued, I've got plenty, I've got stuff, I don't need these gifts. So it wasn't the stuff that broke him down. Something changed him, and he had a change of heart. I argue that it has a lot to do with this wrestling with the Christophany thing, that Christ interjected himself historically at this precise moment because a couple of things were about to happen. Jacob, who is carrying the birthright promise, Jacob, who is carrying the Abrahamic covenant, the one through whom the seed is traveling to get to Christ, he must live. He has to continue. He has to make it back to the promised land and set his sons up there, because that is all part and parcel of the Abrahamic covenant. And so I argue that it is God that changed Esau's heart. Because any time that you see a human being go from angry and murderous to loving and kind, something positive has happened there. That's not human nature. But I also do honestly believe that Moses wrote it in this order and put that Jacob wrestling story right there before the meeting. Notice where it's placed in the history of Jacob. He sent all the gifts. He's approaching his brother. He stays back. He wrestles. Then the next thing you read in the narrative is that then he approaches Esau, and he and Esau are reconciled. Because in the New Testament, Paul writes that Christ and Christianity itself is the ministry of reconciliation. When God intercedes between people, God brings about reconciliation, whether that's reconciliation of man to God or whether that's reconciliation of brother to brother, as we see here. The Spirit of God, the ministry of God, is the ministry of reconciliation. And so this reconciliation that happens between these two brothers, I argue, is the direct result of God's intervention. Had God not protected Jacob, Jacob's a dead man. That's what I'm getting at. Make sense? Starting then at verse 5, he lifted his eyes and he saw the women and the children. That would be Esau that did that. And he said, "Who are these with you?" So he, Jacob, said, "These are the children whom God has graciously given your servant." Notice the language, "your servant." I'm not the greater one here. You are. I'm your humble servant. And the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. And Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" And he said, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." In other words, he's asking the question, why, as I was approaching you, did I see these waves and waves of animals and flocks and gifts and men servants all saying, "These all belong to you"? So he said, "What was the point of all that?" And he said, "It was to find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." And Jacob said, "No, please. If now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. Well, there's a principle at work here. And it's a very biblical principle, and so it's a principle that I need to camp on for a moment. which is that the argument that Jacob makes, even when Esau says, I have plenty, I don't need what you have, Jacob's argument that convinces his brother is, God has been gracious to me, therefore please take my gift. Be gracious in taking my gift because God has been gracious to me. In other words, Jacob's kindness, his graciousness, his giving was a direct result of the fact that he recognized how much God had given him. And because God was kind and gracious to him, he was kind and gracious to his brother. And I think that's a principle that is carried all the way over into the New Testament. It is a principle that we, especially who call ourselves sovereign grace people, we certainly ought to be implementing that principle in our lives, especially with those who are Christians, especially with those who are our brethren, but also among the people of the earth, everybody we bump into. I mean, if Jesus can walk around saying things like, love your enemies, which is really difficult, but if he can say that, then he does expect us to be a different kind of people, the kind of people who don't follow our nature or our flesh, but people who stand out, which is why he could say to his disciples things like, by this will all men know that you are my disciples. That there would be a telltale sign that all human beings would recognize where they would say, well, these must be the disciples of Jesus because they are just so different in the way they act than the way that natural men always act. And that telltale sign was by your love one for another. That Christians would simply be more gracious, more kind, more loving, more friendly, more helpful. That those would be the hallmarks of our Christian life until people would look at us and say, well, I don't know what else to say except these must be Christians. That's the only way to explain them being this way. And I'll tell you this, not to tell tales out of school, but I have been part of the Sovereign Grace circle of churches and part of the Sovereign Grace community for 17 years now. And some of the least gracious people I think I've ever met walk around calling themselves Sovereign Grace people. Now, I'm not saying that to slam Sovereign Grace. I'm saying that it should be a hallmark of anybody who says they believe in the Sovereign Grace of God that they themselves are gracious. And there's this very strange dichotomy whenever I see people who call themselves Christian, and especially those who say that they are Sovereign Grace Christians, who are then hard-hearted or mean-spirited or difficult to get along with. It completely confuses me. I cannot explain why it is that Christian people would not be gracious. Because if you think about it, and okay, let's think about it. If we, in fact, deserve, let's see, hell forever. Let's start with that. What we deserve is to spend the rest of our lives starting right now, because we're already guilty enough that we ought to be in hell already. Every day that you're not in hell is another gracious day. So you ought to be in hell right now, where the fire's never quenched, where the worm never sleeps. If you were to get what you deserve, that's what you'd be getting starting now. And you're not getting that. In fact, you're so not getting that, that you're also getting things like comfort, a place to sleep, clean clothes, a haircut, some of us, food to eat, good quality food to eat, carpeting under your feet, and you know the list. I like the list of all the many ways that we are spoiled, and I recite the list frequently. We are just plain flat spoiled out of our heads. And that's God's grace. That's God's kindness to us. Instead of getting what we deserve, we are living phenomenally comfortable lives because God is just really gracious and really good to us. But then on top of that, when we die, instead of leaving this world fearful that we're going to stand in God's judgment, and that he is going to condemn us eternally and cast us out of his sight to outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's good Bible language. I mean, that's very descriptive language for what it's going to be like to be cast out of God's presence. Instead, we have the promise, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. That's a really good promise. Instead, we have the promise of eternal life. Instead, we have the promise that the God who never changes wrote our names down before the foundation of the world in the Lamb's Book of Life, sent his Son to pay for every sin and trespass we have, and that we are going to spend eternity in his presence. And then, not just in his presence, but joint heirs with Christ in everything Christ alone deserves. Can you get a hold of that?
No.
No? I
can't.
You think you're spoiled now. You think air conditioning and carpet is good. Try streets of gold for a while. Access to the tree of life and the river of life and joining the saints from all the ages in the eternal worship of God in a time and in a place where you don't have this sinful, corrupted, fleshly body holding you down and feeding your brain all the crazy stuff that goes on in your head so that you can finally worship in spirit and in truth and be part of the New Jerusalem and inherit a part of those things that Christ alone deserves. That's how good and gracious God is being to you. Now take all that, call that God's grace. Now, should that be sufficient inspiration for you to also be gracious to other folk? Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you find yourself being ornery with somebody, ungracious, unkind, difficult to somebody, stop poking each other. Whenever you... Too much poking in the back row. and don't poke him. Whenever you find yourself doing that, it is because... Let's just... Bring it down to brass tacks. It's just us here. When you are being unkind to someone else, it is always because you have gotten your eyes so firmly fixed on your own flesh that you think you are justified in your unkindness because that person has made you uncomfortable or unhappy, and you are going to pay them back for what they did to you. That is the typical inspiration for why we're unkind to people. Most of us don't get up in the morning and go, I need to go find someone to be unkind to. We usually start the day inspired to go out there and do our best, put our best foot forward, be a reasonable person. And then we bump into the first human of the day. And if that first human is reasonably nice to us, we carry on okay with them. But if the people we run into are in any way contrary to us, we feel justified jumping all over them because they made us uncomfortable. Here's the point. Your reaction to those people should not be based on you or your flesh or your discomfort. Your reaction to those people should be based on the fact that God was gracious to you and that he could have very easily made you really unhappy and uncomfortable forever. Worms, fire, darkness, teeth gnashing, all that could have been your eternal lot. He could have made you real uncomfortable because it's not as if he's looking at you and going, oh, what a grand improvement this is. We're not bringing anything to the table that is making God say, well, I have to be good to this person. They're such a good person. They're doing so well. I must be good to them. No, this is nothing but an outpouring of God's grace and kindness to us. And that needs to be our inspiration for how we deal with other people. We need to deal with them in a Christ-like manner, and we need to deal with them graciously because God was gracious to us. So the next time you start barking at somebody and being angry at them or feeling like they have affronted you and therefore they need to be the object of your wrath, realize that that's exactly the position you were in before God, the judge of everything. But he did not judge you harshly. He judged you graciously. Therefore, you ought to be that gracious to other folks. Right?
Makes sense.
You all nod like you agree. Yeah, so, but now do it. Yeah, see, there's the tough part.
Crushing them like insects and scattering their ashes to the earth is not an appropriate response.
No.
Baby steps.
Baby steps. Just move little by little through this, yes. See, we all agree with that philosophically. I know that everybody who just heard me say that said, you know, Jim, I agree with that. I agree philosophically, theologically, biblically. Yes, that should be the Christian goal. It'll take you less than 24 hours to completely forget it. But it's right. It's still the goal. It's still where we ought to be heading. And I will tell you this, because I myself, I'm 51 now. I have been in the last several years, how shall we put this, affronted several different ways. I've had a tough few years of people going on the attack. And I have had to defend myself in many different arenas when I was, I thought, unjustly accused and attacked and turned on and everything else. And what that did to me was it could have made me a very angry, bitter, difficult human. And I know people who have been through situations like what I went through, and they came out the other side, angry, bitter, difficult humans. Because trials and struggles in life really do ultimately show what you're made of. And you will either come out better for the experience or worse for the experience. And I believe that if the Holy Spirit of God is in you, when you go through those struggles, that preserving work of the Spirit in you will produce what the writer of Hebrews calls the peaceable fruit of righteousness. You will, despite yourself, come through that process and come out better because the better God, the good and gracious God, is working in you. When you go through terrible experiences and come out worse for it, I think that's usually a demonstration that God has backed away and is letting you grow worse for your experiences in life. But what you should be learning through the difficulties of life is patience and endurance and long-suffering and kindness and grace. And you understand what I'm saying? The principle of grace, which we are also dependent on in our relationship with God, our dependency on grace. We want to be the recipients of God's grace. But the Bible doesn't allow for the kindness of God to stop when it reaches you. The grace and the kindness of God is supposed to flow through you. It's not supposed to get to you and then hit that brick wall of you. And you can't say, well, God's grace is really all about God being gracious to me, and that's as far as it goes. Biblically, God's grace flows through you so that his love and kindness and grace is then demonstrated, and you are salt in the world and light in the world. You are a demonstration of Christian character. If the Christian church demonstrated more kindness and grace, there would be far less political opposition to Christianity in America today. I am convinced of that. If the church were still living up to its original principles and obligations in the society, and instead of just becoming these sort of self-perpetuating social groups that they've become, social networks and stuff,
Showtime,
so that it's just another group of people who are fighting for that entertainment dollar, competing with the world. If the church weren't doing that, but was in fact, do you know why? I know I stopped myself right in the middle of a sentence there. But do you know why the government grants 501c3 status to churches? 501c3 status is the tax-exempt status of churches. There are two essential reasons for it. Do you know what they are? One is because the ability to tax is the ability to control, and so the government, right in our Constitution, is not going to establish a religion. And so if they start taxing one religion and not another religion, then they have the ability to control or be preferential toward some particular religion. And so that was one inspiration of it. The other side of it is that the government was, in its earliest formation, all filled with church-going Christian people, and they recognized that the more that the church did its job socially of helping the hungry, helping the poor, feeding, clothing, doing the good work of showing grace and kindness to those who had less, the more the church did that job, the less the government had to do it. And so it was advantageous to the government to give the church tax advantages to go do the church work. That was less that the government had to do. Now, of course, ever since the Lyndon Johnson Great Society days, ever since the FDR days, really, of all the social welfare programs, now the government has become the great big welfare state because the church, in large amounts, is simply not doing its job. it has become about bring people in and get money out of people so that we can build bigger buildings and put on bigger shows and have more fall draw and do the big broadcasts and be on the satellite and have all that. And as long as that's where they're dumping their money, okay, I won't get into it, but I saw a guy the other day actually argue on TV that when you sent money to them and to their ministry, you were actually helping the poor because they were broadcasting into poor areas. You know, when you're giving to us, you're giving to the poor, which was just as bizarre an argument as I'd ever heard. So I think in many ways, the church in America and the church in the world has failed in one of its primary responsibilities, which is to be salt and light in the world, to be gracious in the world, to be kind, to help our fellow man, to love our enemies, to do the work that is indicative of Christianity itself. Because the church has forgotten what its purpose is in the world. Now, of course, the cure for wrong use is not no use. The cure for wrong use is right use. And so even if we can't change the whole church world, which we apparently can't, nevertheless, we can still argue for graciousness on the basis of grace. We can still say to everybody within our vocal range, everybody who hears us speak, at least we can try to drive those principles that say, look, you're dependent on God's grace. You're dependent on God being kind and merciful to you. Well, then God also expects that you're going to be gracious, kind, and merciful to other people. And far too often it seems that we're kinder and more gracious to strangers than we are to people in our own sphere, in our own circle of friends, in our own marriage, in our own families. Those are the people who seem to be the ones that take the beatings, while the strangers are treated nicely because we think that we get an extra gold star on our forehead if God sees us being nice to a stranger. So we'll feed a bum and then, you know, go yell at the kids. Okay, I was just waiting for you to say something. Okay. All right, so let's move on. That came as a result of Jacob saying, no, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. Thus he urged him, and he took it. I'm being gracious to you because God was gracious to me. That's the argument. Yes.
Also, the giving that is being done has nothing to do with a need on Esau's part any more than our giving to God has to do with a need on God's part.
Yeah. Did you understand what Tom just said? What Tom just said, and it's a really essential point, it's a really important point, is that very frequently people say, well, I would give to the church, but God doesn't need my money. God, to be God, has no needs, and that's exactly right. God has no needs. Therefore, God is not benefited when you give him things. He already owns everything, the cattle on a thousand hills are the Lord's. God actually says, if I were hungry, I would not tell you. He's completely self-sufficient. He doesn't need you to provide him anything. So sometimes people use that as an excuse. And we'll say, well, God doesn't have any needs, or right now your church seems to be financially okay, so I don't need to give to you. The point Tom was making was Esau has made it clear that he doesn't need it. But Jacob needed to give it. Jacob needed to exemplify that all that he had was a gift from God. And he had to exemplify God's grace. And that's a principle that I have tried for years to teach people. God does not need your gift, but you desperately need to give. You don't enrich God when you give him anything, and yet God constantly throughout the Bible requires that you give. And it is because that giving exercise forces you in many ways, teaches you, molds you into being the kind of person who is accustomed to giving. And who recognizes that everything you have is a gift from God. And so you use part of what God has given you for the benefit of other people, for the gift of the church, or even just as a gift back to God in recognition that everything you have comes from Him. And so I think all of the giving requirements in the Bible and all the many admonitions to give in the Bible are really not about, ultimately, money. It's about building character into you. It's about making you into giving-type people, and people who recognize that everything you are and everything you have and every breath you take is from the Lord. And so you come back regularly and give him back a part of what he gave you as a way of recognizing where it came from. Is that what you were saying? Mm-hmm. I know that I said it in more words than you did, but that was the principle, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said it, because it gave me a chance to talk through that. So thus he urged him and he took it. We're not going to get where I wanted to get tonight. That's a given. We're not going to get there. Don't give me that. He gave me the, oh, like anyone didn't know that look. Then Esau said, let us take our journey and go. I will go before you. But he said to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail and that the flocks and the herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. And Esau said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and he built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is Succoth, which is just a Hebrew word that means a booth or a temporary dwelling. The reason that that's important is when God deals with Israel at Mount Sinai and gives them the law, one of the things that he requires from them is that three times a year they go up to Jerusalem and they keep a feast. And one of those feasts is actually called the Feast of Booths. And it's called in the Hebrew tongue Succoth to this day. And what it is that they would either go out of their houses or up on the roof of their house, and they would build a temporary dwelling place. We know that feast by the name Feast of Tabernacles. Temporary houses. Temporary dwelling places. Because he was still traveling here, so he made these booths, these temporary dwellings for the cattle, to keep the rain and the wind off them. And so Israel then was taught to make temporary tabernacles, temporary dwelling places, and once a year for a week they would live outside of their homes in these temporary dwellings. And then Jesus came along. John 1 said that Jesus came and tabernacled among us, which to us doesn't mean that much. But to the Hebrew mindset, they understood immediately what that meant. They had been keeping Feast of Tabernacles 1,400 years. They understood that Succoth, booth, tabernacle meant temporary dwelling. So when you hear that Jesus was God incarnate who came and tabernacled among people, then that means that he came and took up a dwelling that was not his permanent dwelling, which is heaven, but that he came down and tabernacled among his people for a while, dwelt among his people. So God was setting that up all the way back here when he introduced this language of booth and then later saying, that's what you're going to do every year. You're going to do temporary dwellings, and that's going to lead you to understanding Christ when he comes. Isn't that good? It's all just woven in there. Just God very carefully dropping hints as he goes. It's almost like breadcrumbs in the Hansel and Gretel story. It's like as we go, there's just all these little pieces that we can pick up as we go along. So verse 18. Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Padan Aram, and he camped before the city, and he bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel, which basically means El, the name for God, the Hebrew noun that emphasizes might or strength. The essence of the name, then, is El, the God, but then Elohi, the mighty God of Israel. Why is that important? I think it's important because we talk about God here in this church in two ways. We talk about him as being gracious, and we put a lot of emphasis on grace. But it does you no real good in an eternal sense if God is incredibly nice but powerless. Right? If he's a really nice God but has no ability to see his intentions through, that's no help to us. And so another of the intrinsic characteristics of God that is demonstrated all the way through the Bible and is even one of his proper names, God Almighty, All-Powerful, is this demonstrative fact that God has this kind of almighty power, God the powerful God of Israel. So Jacob is pointing out that not only is this a God who is kind and gracious, but this is the God who made heaven and earth. This is the God who, if he says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. If he says you're going to inherit this land, you're going to inherit this land. If he says I'm going to make you a great nation, you're going to become a great nation. Now, later in this same chapter, right on the heels of this name of God, God, the mighty God of Israel, right behind it, that very God is going to show up and he's going to pronounce the Abrahamic covenant yet again. So it's very important to recognize that the God who is making these glorious pronouncements is the God, the mighty God. It's not just the God, the gracious God. It's not just the God who wants to do some stuff. It's not just the God who would like for things to work out. It's the God who actually declares the end from the beginning. And if he says to you, this is yours, it is yours based on the fact that he hasn't changed and he has the power to see his intention all the way through to the end. And that's all built in this name. So he says, Jacob came safely from Shechem and he bought a piece of land, and there on that land he erected an altar, and he called that altar El Elohi Israel, God, the mighty God of Israel, because he's putting emphasis on the fact that God is powerful. And that's really important. And that's one of the reasons that I stress he is sovereign, is that unless he actually has all the power, all of his intentions are of no real use. I have a lot of intentions. I have a lot of plans. I have a lot of things I would like to do, but I can't necessarily do them for lack of power, money, energy, the ability to see it through to the end, the inability to talk people into seeing things my way. I have a lot of difficulties in seeing my will through to the end. But God, who has all the power, can always see his intentions all the way through to the end because he is the mighty one. He is the powerful one. He's the one who has all the ability, right? Now, starting in chapter 34, that begins a story of treachery. It really is a story about Dinah, the only daughter who is among these 12 boys, and Dinah is going to be molested by some of the local men now that they have stopped here in Shechem. And from there, Jacob's going to move on to Bethel because that's really where this whole trip started. He started at Bethel, house of God, and he put up the pillar and anointed it and called it the house of God. And this whole journey has been about getting back to that starting place and recognizing that he left there with nothing and came back with all this. So we can't really get into that. It would take us a good half hour to get through the story, so we'll stop there. But in terms of takeaways for tonight, things that I want to emphasize that I hope you, if you remember anything from tonight, graciousness, kindness toward other people, is not based on the other person. If we react to other people based on who they are, what they're like, if we're reacting to the fact that they were unkind to us or that they rubbed us the wrong way, then we're practically begging God to treat us that way. And we don't want that. We do not want God to treat us according to what we deserve. We want God to be gracious to us. Therefore, the Bible adjures us over and over to demonstrate God's kindness and graciousness toward other people. Is that easy to do? No, of course not. But it is an expected fruit of genuine Christianity, of the Holy Spirit living within us, that we would be a different kind of people. And then secondly, God is the powerful God, and if he is, what that name says, that he is the God, the mighty God of Israel. When exactly did he ever stop being the mighty God of, specifically, Israel? Because for all this Israelology that I talk, and for all the times that I say he must keep every promise he ever made to Israel, I am basing that on the fact that he's, number one, God that doesn't change, and number two, God that has all the power. And so Israel's sinfulness or rebellion or stiff-neckedness, well, that doesn't sound right, does it? Well, anyway, you know what I'm saying.
Obstinance.
Or their obstinance. Yes, we'll just go that way. None of that stops God, because God is not reacting to them on the basis of who or what they are. He's reacting to them on the basis of who he is. He's powerful and he's gracious. Sovereign grace. And so to say that Israel will not receive absolutely every promise God ever made to them would require that God change either in his power so that he can't see his intention through to the end, or he has to change in his grace where he said, oh, never mind, I am going to react to you according to what you deserve. And since you can't prove that God changed in either of those characteristics, I can continue to firmly stand on God will do absolutely everything God ever promised he was going to do, whether that's among individuals like you or I, or whether that's among people groups like Israel, because he is God, the mighty God of Israel.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.